Hello and welcome to the This Week in Cleantech podcast. Each week, our host, David Hunt, speaks to a leading startup, CEO, executive, thought leader, or industry insider in the cleantech sector. Focused on the clean energy and clean mobility transitions, each guest shares the highs and lows of their cleantech journey, their industry insights, and their vision and hopes for the future.
This week we delve back into the world of cleantech investors as I speak to Robert Trezona, head of cleantech at IP Group, as we discuss the technologies that he and his team see as breakthrough technologies and companies in the sector, and what they look for in a startup venture. I hope you enjoy the episode. Hello, Robert. Thanks for joining me on the This Week in Cleantech podcast. Most of our guests are startup CEOs and founders, but seeing as every one of them talks about the importance of funding and getting the right investor, I love also to talk to cleantech investors to get their side of the story. So it's great that you join us to do just that. But before we dig into some of those key investments IP Group have made and what technologies excite you most, and can you share a little bit of your personal journey in cleantech and what led you to your current role?
Yeah, sure. First of all, thanks very much for having me. It's great to talk to this audience and say a bit more about what we do. And if I talk about my own personal journey, I really always worked in the sector. So I'm from a scientific background and did a sort of material science degree and then a PhD and was trying to decide what to do next. And, you know, in the UK, you've got all these tempting jobs in the city.
Yeah.
But my father actually was working in environmental lobbying. He was working on trying to improve emissions from cars with catalytic converters.
Okay.
And he sort of said, you know, it's not often that children always listen to their parents, but he said, you should look at this clean technology area. And this was 99, 2000. I think at the time there was a choice between solar cells and fuel cells.
Yeah.
And I chose fuel cells just because it seemed a more complicated, interesting problem. And then Johnson Matthey were setting up a fuel cell business unit at the time, which looked quite interesting. So, and that was, you know, 19 years ago, and I really haven't looked back. And it's been an exciting place to work for all those years. Lots happened, and I think in the early days, I think people certainly thought that turning down jobs in, you know, investment banking or management consultancy to be paid a lot less money to do hard work, you know, inventing stuff. It wasn't the best choice, but it was a wonderful journey. And of course, we're now seeing how important all the stuff is. So I very much come from that kind of science background. And then from Johnson Matthey, went into a startup, which was a fantastic experience. Did go and spend a bit of time as a consultant, really focusing on energy. Mm-hmm. And then from that role, got a kind of my first investment role. At the Carbon Trust, which is a really exciting mission sort of led organization,
yeah.
And joined IP Group nearly 8 years ago. I sort of think like a scientist and you know, look at these technologies from that perspective. And of course, enjoy meeting founders and engineers and scientists working in the cleantech companies themselves.
Sure. I think some of those skills we'll revert to in terms of some of the stuff that IP Group does. But I think it comes back to some of the points you were there about hopefully having the last laugh, because the amount of investment going into clean tech and the importance now we're seeing in all of these technologies on a global basis is hopefully makes you somewhat more attractive in every sense than an investment banker.
Indeed. And actually, when we set the division up formally in IP Group, which was a year and a bit after I started, there was controversy in even calling it cleantech. There were people saying, you know, you can't call it that and it doesn't work and you've got to call it sustainability. But we stuck with the label and we're delighted that we did. And of course, now it seems obvious that people should invest in the space. But
yeah.
You know, back in the early part of this decade, it was regarded as not a good area for capital. And we've sought to be part of proving that to be wrong. And of course, momentum now is very much in our favor.
Absolutely. And I guess it's something I heard actually, you also were presenting at the IGU Summit in Berlin last year. And I don't recall which speaker it was, but was talking about cleantech to some extent is not a sector, but it's an umbrella for a number of sectors. And that perhaps leads us on to the sort of next stage in terms of some of the investments and some of the areas that you feel are most active at the moment. But before again we do that, I mean, IP Group are a bit different in that you invest and focus on very early stage companies and technologies. Can you share a little bit about the ethos and the investment strategy of the group?
Yes, absolutely. I've been thinking about how we describe this. The ultimate value of our companies will tend to be because they have a solution that's very, very different from other offerings in the market. And I have lots of friends in sort of more conventional investment organizations who are really backing great teams or great business models. But what we tend to be looking for is a solution that is very different and obviously ideally outperforms by some margin alternatives. And a way of getting there is to start off with scientific discovery. So original science, and that was part of my sort of presentation at ICA Summit, was to find people in the scientific community who are sort of intrinsically motivated and want to do something different and explore avenues that maybe aren't getting as much attention.
Yeah.
So we really look for those people. And in some cases, we have relationships with them that might last for a couple of years before we actually even make an investment. We're looking for people who really want to solve some of these problems and are coming at it from a different angle. And that doesn't always work out. But if you do find one of those sort of novel ways of thinking and novel discoveries and get it all the way through, seed, series A and so on to market, at that point, you've got something that'll look very different and provide a different solution to customers.
Yeah.
So that's the sort of why we would do something like sourcing as early stage. The how really is going in very early and being a big part of building the company. So it's not for us a case of meeting lots and lots of established companies with professional management teams and business plans. We're looking at the sort of the kind of core distinctiveness early on. Often we incorporate the companies ourselves. We help them hire people to complement the founding team, and we also help them raise money. So we can help our companies raise capital and set their strategies as they go forward. So we use this term business builder, and that's a good description for that process. And the challenges are, of course, that it takes a long time and it's quite labor intensive. So there's a cost for us, if you like. But the benefit is once you've got to a certain stage with the company, you'll have something with that differentiation that's often quite special.
Yeah.
And you can have a fair amount of confidence that really is going to be something that will do very well in the market once it's proven.
Sure, sure. So the obvious place to look for those types of organizations are spinning outs from universities. And I know that that's where perhaps a number of your investments have come from. But is that the sole source? I mean, where else would you find somebody at that very early stage with a specific, as you say, scientific IP to lead on?
Yeah, it's not the sole source. I would say 80% of our companies are classic spin outs. We've had a few where it's been a spin out that has gone into trouble, and we've done a sort of rescue round, or it's IP from a corporate that they weren't going to use, and we were able to sort of repurpose that for a business.
Yeah.
And on a couple of occasions, it's been individuals, but those individuals might be people from an engineering background who had at least, filed some patents or had acquired their patents maybe from a former employer.
Yeah.
So that IP rich thing is the sort of common ground, and mostly from universities. And back to that distinctiveness point, when we work with universities and scientific publications, what we're sort of doing there is using the kind of global peer review process to help us understand whether something is really distinctive. So if a professor has published a really interesting discovery in Nature, and a few of ours do come from that sort of high impact publication, then that's a good clue that this approach, this technology, the invention is probably quite distinctive. So that helps us get started. And because it takes such a long time, you really don't want to sort of put all that effort in onto something that's derivative and not distinctive. We're looking for something that has that sort of kind of ideally global uniqueness.
Right.
And leading universities, and we work with 20 or so universities around the world, are great places to go and look for those kind of scientific breakthroughs.
Sure, sure. And you touched on there sort of helping those organizations at an early stage to gain additional funding. Are you always the seed and first or dominant investor, or do you co-invest with any other particular organizations?
So because of that approach and the fact that actually you don't want to commit a very large amount of capital in those early years because of the timescales, we will always be the first institution to come in. There have been a few cases where someone has found some angels, friends and family, but we will tend to be the first institution. Thereafter, because, again, of the timescales and you know, really, we are sort of mostly working with hardware. The capital requirements, we will seek to syndicate and look for people to partner.
Yeah.
And so often quite early on, you know, I'm in the seed stage business. I'll know people in the kind of broader clean tech venture community, and I'll be having conversations with them like, you know, we funded this business for 18 months towards a Series A. You know, what are the things that you would be looking at specifically as a co-investor to come into this asset in, you know, a year's time? So we're very collaborative with the broader community, and I guess they would see us as a source of deal flow.
Sure, sure. I think one of the things I really enjoyed in talking to yourself and Ben and others in the team is that you are, as you say, going for the moonshot businesses rather than the usual where a lot of the money goes. But that said, there's one thing I wanted to touch on, because I think perhaps we have a good example of your ethos and one of your companies, which is the Cozy. So perhaps, which is obviously in and related to lithium batteries, which is getting a lot of the investment at the moment. But that's not something you've recently, or a company you've recently exited from. So perhaps you can just share a little bit about that journey as an example of your involvement and the types of technologies which you're investing in.
Yeah, sure. So it's a good case study. One aspect I haven't mentioned yet is because of the timescales over which these companies mature, we will tend to normally have some sort of overall strategic thesis around an area. So what you don't want to have is backing a really exciting technology at the early stage, which might take 10 or more years to mature, and you get to that maturity point 10 years hence, and it's just not what the market wants at that point. So we kind of form fairly strong hypotheses around the different sectors, storage, generation, efficiency, and so on.
Yeah.
In storage, we had probably about 5 years ago come to the view that there was a lot of activity happening around chemistry and a lot of that in corporate R&D labs. And it was very hard to be distinctive in novel chemistry. But the BMS piece really hadn't been solved. There wasn't the dominant sort of technology or approach there. And it was sort of up for grabs. So we were actually actively looking for something to do in BMS. And Ducozy, at the point where we came across the company, was a sort of very successful IC, so integrated circuit chip design company, founded by two Edinburgh profs. So it wasn't itself at that point the university spin-outs, but it was doing some interesting things. They had some IP from a corporate, so that's another source that I mentioned earlier, around this concept of having distributed management of large automotive battery packs. And we got to know the company well, we put some funding in, but more than just the sort of capital, we helped them find complementary technologies from universities. So we had relationships with people doing interesting work on things like near-field communication and firmware, sort of lightweight, efficient sort of firmware on chips that allows you to manage and make measurements locally close to the battery. So we brought that into the company. And we also brought in a couple of different people over that period, sort of 5 year period, to manage the company. So it really was a kind of aggregation into a sort of, you know, ultimately quite exciting company from various sources that came from our network.
Yeah.
And at the point where we had this exit, we actually sold the company to another investor, a private equity firm called KCK. And what we found, they'd had a similar hypothesis around what would be valuable in the space. And that then became quite a sort of constructive conversation about why we both kind of came to this view. And they ended up, for various reasons, being a kind of natural owner of the company. So it was a really sort of nice example of identifying a need in the space, kind of building a business to meet that need, and then finding an acquirer who'd sort of seen the same opportunity. In our case, quite a short, you know, it's 5-6 years later.
Yeah, I was going to touch on that because, again, when you are involved very early, as we all know, those early years are the most challenging, but they, you know, they do take some time. So is there a typical time frame from you from investment to exit?
I would say that we would start at saying to ourselves, this may take a decade. And if we can't, if we're starting with raw IP out of a university, that's the sort of time frame you need to be prepared for. There might be opportunities to exit sooner. But, you know, and the history then is quite illustrative. If you look back at successful companies, I met the COO of First Solar last week, for example. They've all taken, you know, reality more than a decade to really get to maturity. So, yeah. So we look at that time scale, and that just makes you think differently. It makes you think differently about the quantity and cost of initial capital, and about the types of people and business models that you might adopt for the companies. We're fortunate as IP Group in having a sort of slightly different source of capital from a conventional venture capital investor. So we source our capital from a company. So we're a listed company. And then we therefore don't have a hard end to a fund. So if you have a closed end VC fund, then of course, you know, you're normally looking to exit your positions ahead of the closure of the fund.
Yeah.
We have an evergreen source. So that's an important part of it. But it also then kind of informs how we think about planning for the companies, things like also looking to get some grant funding into them and get early engagements from corporates as well.
Okay. And again, it would be useful perhaps to share, if we can, some of the other, I don't want to put you in a position of picking and choosing out of the portfolio, but perhaps you can share a few examples of the technologies that you've invested in and then more so why you've chosen those particular companies and technologies.
Yeah, sure. So it's quite a diverse portfolio. And I'll go through some of the sort of currently most valuable companies. So the one that is our most valuable holding today is Ceres Power, which is a fuel cell company. Yeah. And that sort of, you know, fairly uniquely in the fuel cell space has a totally different sort of cell material set to any of the other fuel cell companies. And that difference and the advantages that are delivered from that are being recognized now by big customers like Bosch. So that's maybe the largest company. Then we've got First Light Fusion, which is actually where I'm at today. I'm at their offices right now. And that's a company pursuing fusion energy, as everyone appreciates, a very long-term and challenging area to work in.
Yeah.
The reason we invested in that company is the way that they're proposing to get to fusion is totally novel and distinctive, and it's based on some really, really impressive science from Oxford. So we've gone into it, you know, with eyes wide open, with all the various timescale risks, but the quality of the science, and the pace of innovation in the company is really quite something. So there's two very different companies there. Ceres now has products. First Light is really, still doing developing technology.
Yeah.
And then maybe a third one I'll pick out, which is an unusual one for us, but, something we really believe in is a company called Azuri. Which is a pay-as-you-go solar company marketing domestic solar systems in Africa on a kind of microcredit basis. Not really an IP-rich company, but it's an example of our kind of interest. You know, why we're doing this stuff. We're trying to provide clean energy and you know, help the clean transition. Mm-hmm. Azuri was a spin-out from a spin-out, so we had funded. When I was at Carbon Trust, and some of my team here at IP Group are also with me at Carbon Trust, we'd funded a spin-out from University of Cambridge with very novel technology in organic photovoltaics called 819. That business didn't work out in its original form, but we had a very strong entrepreneur in Simon Bransfield Garth, and he came to us and said, well, actually, I think this might work in this sort of sub-Saharan Africa context. Mm-hmm. And we did a kind of the mother of all pivots from being a kind of, you know, mainstream solar farm, grid-connected technology developer to being a business model company in Africa. But it's worked out very well. They're very successful. They have some great technology around predicting the energy use of their customers and, you know, continuing to get energy demand out of the kit, but it's not quite sort of deep university science. Mm-hmm. But I think all of those three companies have about them a different approach. You know, there's a sort of contrarianism around the people involved and a quality of the innovation that they're pursuing, which is kind of our style.
Okay, and then that's again a couple of things are there to talk on. One of which is obviously we're talking about IP and primarily hardware. So I want to move on to perhaps discussions around software, which is where a lot of things are, or that combination where a lot of these things are going. But typically, when you talk to an investor, one of the main things, of course, is the technology, but is also the management teams. But when you're looking for these real big technology opportunities, is that so important to you? And if so, how do you address the fact you may have someone with some great IP, but a really poor lead scientist from a commercial sense?
Yeah, it's a good question. And we sort of start from the problem that we're looking to solve, as I described earlier, and then it's down to sort of the quality of the idea and the technology. And in some cases, the people originally involved are fabulous leaders and can stay with the business and want to stay with the business. Mm. That may be half the time. In other occasions, and increasing what we're finding as you know the whole sector kind of matures a bit, is people maybe out of a university lab who don't have the sort of, I mean, just really a mindset rather than a skill set. Sure. To be an entrepreneur, don't want to. You know, academic careers now are quite demanding, and stepping out to be in a spin-out is a big decision. So, you know, about half the time we've got a founder like a Nick Hawker at First Light Fusion, or a Pete Armstrong, say, at Mixergy, who's just a natural-born entrepreneur, and those are wonderful, you know, people to work with.
Yeah.
In other cases, you know, it normally falls on us as the first institutional investor to build a management team. And I would say that is, you know, one of the harder things that we have to do, because you have to bring somebody in to, you know, give all that sort of energy and passion to somebody else's idea.
Yeah.
So to help us do that, we actually have an internal, you know, search function within IP Group, and quite a big network of people that we know who are really passionate about clean tech. And it's a big chunk of the job is finding those people. So let's take Series Power. The person that we brought in there, it was someone we'd identified, you know, had been another fuel cell company, mm-hmm. Had a great reputation, particularly around on commercial deal doing. And, you know, in that case, it was really a question of us training him that the series actually was pretty exciting. But you really have to look for, if you're building that team and bringing people in, the alignment of interest and values, and that person is going to work well with the founders and other people in the business. But that's probably where we have this kind of dislocation that's different from a conventional venture investor, where you're backing a team.
Yeah.
We're kind of backing an idea, maybe some of the team, and then having to complement them with additional people.
Yeah, and those can be big challenges. Majority of our clients at Hyperion are startups at one stage, usually post-investment, but there's a lot of vested interest emotionally in those leaders and founders, and it's not always easy to get people to see that what they need is not necessarily what they want, and vice versa.
Yeah, no, I agree, and I think that's, I mean, because most of the clean tech team at IP Group has worked as we've kind of worked as scientists and engineers, often in startups. Our ability to have those conversations is maybe enhanced. I'll be in labs talking to people about my own experience as a former scientist and engineer, and that thing that helps a bit. And you know, we've had situations where if someone really wants to be heavily involved, you know, given the time that we've got, we're happy to allow people to try it out. But you know, within a context of this is the type of outcomes we're looking for. So it's an ongoing people thing. And really, you know, I guess we start with a technology and idea in that first decision, which might take 6 months as we're doing DD and so on.
Right.
And then it might be 10 years, and that those 10 years are about people. So the people piece, and of course, you know this incredibly well. Once you know the assets are in your portfolio and you're backing them, it's all people.
Yeah. And again, that's an ongoing challenge at different stages of the business, because you need different people for different stages of the evolution of any business.
Yes, absolutely. So you know, we might start out with 3, 4, 5, 6 person team, and you know, of course, the prize for success is money and scale and complexity. And you know, occasionally we'll maybe have somebody who will say, look, you know, for this first period, it was like a term like a launch CEO. We think you're the right person to lead this business. But then, you know, if it works, we will need these other skills. It might be operational skills, if there's any manufacturing involved, or business development skills. Depending on that person's kind of impact on the company, if the individual is kind of the clear thought leader that, you know, inspires people, we'll complement that person with those other skills. In other cases, and normally we'll have signaled on this right from the outset, you're looking for somebody else to take over. And that's really a question of getting the incentives right. We think those early years are critical, and we're very happy for people to do well for doing that part of the journey. Mm-hmm. But the challenge is, you know, completely change as businesses scale. And one of the risks that we're constantly trying to manage in startups, it's hard work and people are very focused on delivering against, you know, say milestones, is being aware of things that you as a small company probably are not very good at, and what is happening, particularly in large engineering companies. And as soon as you get into logistics and operations and procurement, you know, a good, you know, large corporate is so much better. And if nobody in your small company has ever seen what that looks like, there's a real kind of reinventing the wheel risk, which is, you know, super inefficient for us as investors and slows everyone down.
Yeah, for sure. I want to touch on something else you talked about at the beginning is, you know, it's a global issues that we face, and clean tech is a global entity. How do you find companies, or do you find companies outside of the UK and Europe? Well, the reason I ask is we recently started working with a company which was Google Moonshot company called Malta Incorporated in thermal management storage. Obviously, they had money from Breakthrough Energy Ventures and lots of money to really attack things very hard, and we've helped them scale their team quite dramatically. In the US, there seems to be that appetite for, you know, very fast and very quick investments that doesn't seem to be the case, generally speaking, in Europe. Do you have a global portfolio? Do you have a feeling as to why that might be?
Yes, I can sort of probably talk to both of those things. We now have offices in the US, in Australia, and actually in China, in Hong Kong.
Okay.
So we're starting to sort of look at sourcing more globally. We're not actually mandated only to source in the UK, but, you know, the way we do this, you know, the investment sort of selection, decision making, it's quite hands on and it's quite local. So, you know, the portfolio is UK focused because that's where we started with the team. Having said that, we've now got two assets in Australia in cleantech and one in the US, and that's been quite exciting to be able to sort of work with, you know, research institutions. One's out of NREL in the US, the other two out of universities in Australia.
Right.
And as well as just opening up to additional sources of IP, you can start to play a sort of technology arbitrage between these different countries, where, you know, certain, you know, geographies are really good at certain areas. So the UK, I would say, is actually very good at things like electrochemistry around, say, fuel cells, flow batteries, and so on. Mm-hmm. Australia really isn't, but it's very strong in solar and ag tech. US is the biggest investor in R&D in the world still in this space. And places like NREL are world centers, and of course, very strong in things like solar. Mm-hmm. So we're starting to be able to, if we see a new piece of IP, in addition to sort of looking at the sort of publication literature, reach out to people from universities all over the world and say, look, have you ever seen anything like this? And then maybe with some of our more mature assets, we can start to do that sort of technology matching, where we'll say to somebody, you know, say with a vehicle program, well, look, and if you're looking for a fuel cell technology for a range extender for this application, an Australian company, for example, we know people in the UK probably don't know much about. So that global thing is quite exciting for us. And I guess the UK has been a good place to start. And characteristics of the UK are pre-money valuations and real costs, you know, per unit you know, dollar, pound, euro, mm-hmm. are lower, much lower definitely than the US.
Yeah.
The corollary, though, is absolutely this ambition and scale thing that you mentioned with respect to, say, Malta. And that's something that we're keen to try and get over by you know, trying to be ambitious for our companies and help them access global markets and global pools of capital. So as well as looking for deals in the US, Australia and China, there's quite a lot of capital interested in clean tech in those geographies. And we've yeah. had quite a lot of investments, quite big chunky checks coming into UK companies so far from overseas. So that's how we're sort of trying to address that. But I think the UK is still high on inventiveness and science and still light on capital, despite you know, our efforts and others' efforts in the space.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. If we turn to something we talked about earlier, and that's what I love about the conversations we've had, you've got everything in your portfolio from, you know, hot water tanks at Mixergy to nuclear fusion, which is, you know, mind-blowing to those who aren't really into the science. So that's great. So you must see an awful lot of technologies and have to explore that. So perhaps from a personal level rather than from an IP group point of view, which technologies excite you most, and where do you see the sort of the big impacts coming to address the climate crisis that we face?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And I mean, we're very mission focused. And as part of that, we do work kind of outside the conventional investment work to really understand what we need to do to get to net zero as soon as possible. And that means we work with people like the Energy Transitions Commission, with lots of other sort of big corporates to sort of understand what their roadmap looks like. And from that analysis, and it's you know, big chunky amounts of data, there is a sort of a roadmap emerging around how we do this, which is really around electrify. Well, first of all, decarbonize power, mostly with renewables, but we don't think it's possible to do it entirely with renewables. That needs storage as well. And then once you've got those low carbon electrons, electrify everything you possibly can. So electrify space heating with, say, heat pumps.
Yep.
And then you've got a residue at the end, which are things that are really hard to do with electrons. And that creates an opportunity for, you know, the scientific discipline of electrochemistry. So taking those increasingly low cost low carbon or zero carbon electrons and turning them into molecules to do useful stuff. Mm-hmm. So an example would be hydrogen, which we think we're convinced that we will need large quantities of zero carbon hydrogen to get to net zero across things like steel, maybe long haul aviation, shipping via ammonia. So that discipline of you know, taking solar, wind, etc., electrons and electrolyzing water, or even directly taking nitrogen from the air and making ammonia, I think it's really exciting. And I think we have not had nearly the investment and innovation in that electrolysis space that we've had in obviously in things like solar and even fuel cells. So mm-hmm. the globally, there were about 100 and something megawatts of electrolyzers produced last year. It's tiny compared to any of the other technologies. There's some great you know early technologies out there. There's alkaline systems are quite established. There's some PEM stuff coming through. Mm-hmm. We think solid oxide electrolyzer cells SOECs are really exciting. But in that space, there's actually a huge amount of different things you can do with systems. So as soon as you can electrochemically reduce things, you can do things with carbon. So you can use captured carbon to make synthetic fuels. You can make ammonia. You can use ammonia obviously for agriculture, but also you can combust ammonia in ship engines to replace fuel oil. So we think that's going to be, it's not even going to be, if we get to net zero, electrochemistry will become a huge industry. It's effectively going to replace the oil and gas industry. So, you know, if you look at the global energy flows we have today, a lot of coal mm-hmm. for power, but, you know, a lot of the oil and gas goes into molecules, and molecules are used for sort of transport and industry and heating. Where we will still need molecules in the future, those have got to come via electrochemistry. That's cells and it's electrolyzers and maybe being used then ultimately in fuel cells. So that whole space we think is really exciting, and we're doubling down on investments in those areas. And as soon as you start thinking through what that might look like, there are sort of requirements to store these materials, compress them, use of them, and then different systems that become available. Quite a fun implication of lots of availability of green hydrogen is the application of hydrogen in aviation. So people are doing lots and lots of work happening now on small aircraft that are battery powered, battery electric. But you know, it is very difficult to really get the kind of gravimetric energy density down for batteries for long distance flight. If you want to do say 1,000 kilometers, hydrogen is quite bulky, but you know, per unit mass, it's the densest energy store we have. So if you have a lot of green hydrogen available, you can start to do some really interesting things around aviation via electric motors and probably a battery. Mm-hmm. But we think there's going to be big changes to transport in general, but aviation, shipping, maybe rail in particular, around all this electrochemistry as well.
Yeah, I think that's one of the interesting things, and maybe it's there is so much investment in some of the obvious places at the moment around lithium-ion batteries and e-mobility, and absolutely that's all vital, and we play a big part in that ourselves. But looking at some of those really hard to address areas that you don't really think of on a day-to-day basis, I think we talked about the other day the unsexy areas like manufacturing concrete and global shipping, which clearly is a massive issue, and in themselves actually very large chunks of the carbon budget that we have. Do you think there's enough focus on those sorts of technologies or sectors?
Not yet. And I sort of do a talk to researchers at universities called Innovation Needs for 1.5 degrees. And it's kind of, scientists, or former scientists to current scientists saying, look, given that research you do today may take 10, 20 years before it turns into products in the market, have a sort of longer view. Mm. And it's imperative that things like, the carbon intensity of cement gets solved, steel and construction. There are all these huge sources of carbon that aren't very high profile. Whereas if you went and in the university did some research on a novel cathode material for lithium-ion batteries, you just don't know if 100 people are doing the same work with more money and better equipment in LG. Yeah. Whereas, novel sort of building materials, indeed with cement, lots of potential for carbon negative building materials is a really exciting area. And then you're into sort of things like the application of timber in multi-story buildings for structural parts, which does work, and just needs thinking about the supply chain and the ultimate sort of how far can you go. There's a 9-story building in London. Australia's got quite a few that are over 10 stories, and buildings out of timber is just a fabulous thing to do from a carbon perspective. It's almost the innovation, where do people go and do innovation, is inefficient. There's a lot of sort of me tooism because people can maybe get it grant funded more easily. But if people want to have the most impact, there are these unsexy areas that suddenly, I think in about 5-6 years time, as we start to have carbon prices and embodied carbon regulations, people will be saying, well, how do I do this with zero carbon? And people with those technologies will be advantaged. Timing is the thing as well. When I was at Carbon Trust, I used to run the grant funding portfolio. And at that time, we saw people coming through in the late 2000s with lots of great chemistries that were low or zero carbon cement clinkers. Mm-hmm. But the industry wasn't ready. No one would finance a building with some crazy new material. Yeah. It is going to be ready in the next few years. So the timing is now. And those kind of harder to abate sectors that are lower profile are absolutely ripe for innovation.
Yeah, I think it's one of the fascinating things. Go back to your background in material science, those and nanotechnologies, which you may have a view on. But I was in San Diego last week and talking to a board member of a company who have a coating which they retrofit and newly install on air conditioning, which makes it 30% more efficient. And that's, it's an area that you don't think of as being addressable, but we look at how much air conditioning is used globally and obviously likely to increase as temperatures increase, ironically. That's the fascinating thing for me. Some of these areas which are not on the radar, not on the news, not in your newsletters every morning, that really can make the biggest impacts.
No, I totally agree. And I think if you look at, space heating and probably, as you say, even a bigger issue, cooling in, say, countries like India, we have to have better solutions for that. We think initiatives like the Global Cooling Prize are really, really helpful. The finalists have been announced for that. There's some really exciting technologies there. And again, for those people, not many people looking at barocalorific solid state, cooling technologies, in the world compared to people maybe looking at, say, perovskites and PV or novel lithium ion. So the sort of heating and cooling, it's all about thermodynamics and actually also system design around buildings is incredibly important. And there's some great innovation to come.
Super. Look forward to seeing that progressing. So from what advice would you give to startup founders who have a unique IP, apart from to give you a call, what should they consider or what should they have in place before speaking to an investor?
I think the sector has obviously improved and evolved and become a lot more sophisticated. And I think one of the things that or maybe mistakes people make is the assumption that if you've got some really exciting novel IP you want to really extract value from that and see it become commercial, that you should be secretive and try and do everything yourself. And it's not actually as an academic, people are kind of head down doing their own work and trying to get papers published and so on. Academia is less collaborative than I think people necessarily think would guess. Okay. So the first thing is really to go and talk to people and be incredibly, if you've got, and we're talking about patents here, so if you've got strong patent coverage, so you filed a patent that's kind of gone through and get good advice on that, definitely. But if you're confident in the strength of those initial patent filings, there's no real risk in going and talking to people at conferences, at sort of startup events. There are many of those. I mean, universities and in cities like London, and just talking about what you're doing, because from that space all the way through, it's a long journey, and there are many kind of pitfalls as you go through. And being equipped with more knowledge and, in fact, more relationships is always going to be helpful. So I think I would absolutely encourage people to do that. And it's not obvious to people from the kind of technical background. The other thing to say, we clearly don't and can't fund all of the great sort of innovation even coming out of the UK, is the angel and crowd investing mechanism for those early stages is really maturing. We're lucky in the UK for incentive programs like the EIS scheme. Those are really powerful. Because this country has, because of its financial services industry and service industry in general, quite a lot of relatively wealthy people who maybe did engineering degrees and also want to do something positive. Getting into, networks of angel investors or crowdfunding platforms or EIS aggregators is a good way of getting those early a couple of years funded, raising between a few hundred thousand up to, in some cases, millions. And there, that's all about back to some networking relationships thing. There are lots of people out there who want to invest in early stage technologies that have the potential to help us solve climate change. Absolutely pick people that you're have values aligned with, not the people who might give you maybe the highest pre-money valuation. And we've seen a lot of success stories, for example, like Yasa Motors here in Oxford, that was kind of all angel EIS funded for the first 8 years. And it's a very successful company. You absolutely can do that. And there aren't many people as institutions like us. Anytime I meet a government minister, I get the question, what can we do? And the first thing is, whatever you do, don't mess with EIS.
Right.
You've got to keep that. And it's been incredibly powerful for the space.
Yeah. No, we're taking advantage ourselves recently. But as you say, that early stage, and there are a number of people, as you say, wealthy individuals who really do have a passion to do something with their money on a positive sense. And it's great that there are organizations at all scales that perhaps can support on that. So listen, it's been really great to share some of those stories. One thing I'd like to close with, as often do, is to, you know, you've been in the clean tech sector for an awful long time. So are there any books, mentors, thought leaders, or things which continue to inspire you personally in your business, in your journey and in your role?
Yeah, no, thanks. So I think a book, I think the whole team has read this in the last couple of years, is Principles by Ray Dalio. So, you know, the founder of the Bridgewater Hedge Fund.
Yeah.
And you know, that book is a sort of life coaching, but a lot of it is actually about how one goes about making investment decisions, and that wrapped in with the history of him as an individual and Bridgewater as a firm. And what we like about it is this sort of open humility about big mistakes that they made along the way, but having the sort of resilience to carry on, learn from the mistakes, and over time they develop this approach of you know, everything they do becomes a learning opportunity.
Yeah.
And I think for investors, I learn things all the time. You know, I'm constantly amazed by, and it's not just new technologies, it's ways of thinking about doing investments and mm-hmm. commercializing things and building teams. So remaining humble, remaining open to learning new things and listening is incredibly important. And what they do in Principles is really sort of think carefully about the psychology of ego and decision making and how to make really good quality decisions. So that's it's a great book. It's good fun. It's available on audiobook, and there's a video version of it as well. In terms of people, I mean, there are various people we've worked with over the years. One who comes to mind, who sadly passed away a few years ago, but has had quite a big impact, is Professor Brian Steele, who's another material scientist. And he actually worked with John Goodenough on the lithium ion cathode, so all those years ago. But the thing he then did, and the reason we find Brian inspiring, is he decided, I don't know, probably late 80s, early 90s, that ceria as a fuel cell electrolyte was just a great material. And I've seen letters and sort of rejection things from funding councils and stuff saying this is never going to work. It's totally impractical. You know, this is, you know, just a totally academic exercise. Yes, it's a fast ion conductor, but it has all these drawbacks. And of course, his work and that vision, it would totally different from anybody else. Yep. Well, I'm going to solve that by putting this unique material onto thin steel foil to make a fuel cell that way is now series power. But, you know, I had the privilege to sort of work with him and meet him. And as an individual, you know, he was in his 70s then, just a sort of energetic, enthusiastic, friendly, infinitely curious person who just had this determined that I just think this is going to be important. And that's your kind of ideal entrepreneur. You know, we describe Brian as a science entrepreneur. He was pushing back against 10 years of sort of being kind of not laughed at, but kind of ignored. And now we have a company that's worth $300 million with customers, you know, beating a path to its door. So figures like that are people who are really going to help us, you know, solve this climate crisis and deliver wonderful new technologies.
Great. Well, appreciate you sharing that. We'll post links to Brian Steele's work and to the book on the episode page. Really appreciate your time, Robert. It's good to talk to you. I'm sure we'll catch up at an event in the near future. But thanks very much for joining us today and for sharing your insights.
Great. Thank you very much.
Hope you enjoyed that conversation with Robert Trezona. Collaboration with the common objective to solve the world's problems through technology drives us at Hyperion, and I'm sure all of you who listen on this podcast. Please do share the episode and your thoughts and feedback. Thank you for listening.